thank you very much, Cindy, for that wonderful introduction. And thank you very much to the organizing committee for inviting me to speak about one of my favorite topics that I'm very passionate about, which is melding some of the wonderful genetic talks we had this morning into how that's going to affect our reproduction in dogs. I am fortunate enough to be the resident at UPenn in medical genetics and reproduction, which is a very unique aspect in veterinary medicine. It's the only program that really focuses on merging these two topics together, which I think fit very nicely, and hopefully that is something that will continue in some of the veterinary schools. So I'm going to talk to you today about some of the newer topics that we have and new techniques that we have in canine reproduction. In order to do that, I have to focus a little bit about some of the unique considerations in our dogs. I won't talk too much about, I'll try not to take too much time talking about the canine estrus cycle, but we do have to mention some of these aspects because even though we've known about this for quite a long time, it does offer some of the obstacles in terms of how we're going to improve some of our breeding successes. So we're going to talk a little bit about timing. We've heard a lot about that for those of you in dealing with dog breeding, and that's something that continuously comes up, but we'll explain that that's also one of the limiting factors for working with dogs and applying some of these techniques that are available in other species. We talked a lot about how dogs can be models for human genetic diseases and how in some ways we can also look at humans and apply that to dogs. This is where sometimes it becomes a little bit of a challenge when we're talking about reproduction and those techniques. This is the other area that becomes a challenge, which is controlling the estrus cycle, and it's a key factor when we're looking at how we're going to implement some of those techniques. We'll mention a little bit about some of the semen cryopreservation because that's an important way for us to improve on some of our genetics as well as being able to share that, maintain those genetics for a lot of our working dogs. How we're going to use those with some assisted breeding techniques, what's available in the future, and certainly we want to mention a little bit about DNA because that's been talked about quite a bit this morning. I just want to make sure that hopefully it won't be too much of a repeat. Sorry, I can't seem to get rid of that. There we go. So dogs are fairly unique in their estrus cycle, and a couple of key points are that they have delayed oocyte maturation. So they're very unique in that from other species that we deal with, and that becomes a big obstacle when we look at some of these future techniques that we're going to try and implement in the dog. The dog actually ovulates a primary oocyte, so it's not fertile at the time of ovulation. It generally takes about 2 days for that oocyte to mature, and then it's going to be fertile for another potentially 3 days, giving this fertility window of about 2 to 5 days in the dog. Dogs are also unique in that they have a pre-ovulatory rise in progesterone. So most other species that we look at, actually the progesterone comes from the corpus luteum, which is a structure on the ovary after ovulation. In dogs, they're unique in that those follicular cells start to transition to luteal cells just prior to ovulation. This is actually a good thing for us because it allows us to use progesterone in that initial rise to help us with our timing. Progesterone is also similar in bitches whether they're pregnant or non-pregnant. And so that's another factor that becomes somewhat unique in dealing with dogs. We can consider dogs that go through their period of diestrus following ovulation as a time of covert pseudo-pregnancy. So their body is going through the same hormonal changes whether they're pregnant or not. Some dogs will actually have an overt pseudo-pregnancy where they will start to take socks, shoes. Some of these dogs may actually lactate and may nurse the family cat. Who knows? It becomes fairly troublesome for some private owners. Another unique thing about dogs is that they go through an obligate anestrus phase. So unlike some of our other species, like cattle, for example, that continuously cycle and don't go through this period of anestrus, dogs actually go through this every time they cycle. Part of the reason is that they need about 120 to 150 days for the endometrium of their uterus to repair itself, involute, and prepare for the next potential chance that they could be pregnant. So this is a key factor we have to think about when we're talking about how we can manipulate dog cycles and what kind of progress we can make in terms of the reproductive techniques that we are going to apply to this species. There's a large variation in dogs. We know from just looking at sizes and breeds that we can see we have things like Chihuahuas and Great Danes that don't even look like the same species in some instances. So that same variation actually applies to their estrus cycle. They can have a wide variety of cycle lengths between dog breeds and even in individuals. And we can see a big variety in terms of onset to puberty. So all of those things offer a big challenge when we're thinking about how we're going to best utilize reproductive performance. Also unique are some of the diseases that affect the reproductive system. So pyometra, or an infection in the uterus of the dog, is something that we see with an increased incidence. A lot of that has to do with that hormonal profile that dogs go through, that continuous exposure to estrogens and progesterones, whether they're pregnant or not, continues to cause some proliferation to that uterine lining, resulting in some endometrial hyperplasia, abnormal uterus in some of our older dogs, predisposing them to infection or pyometra. Dogs also are very sensitive to progestogens. And we know this from using progestogens, particularly in trying to control the estrus cycle, in that we see dogs have an increase in insulin resistance, so diabetes can be one of the complicating factors with long-term progestogen use in dogs. We'll also see that endometrial proliferation. So acromegaly can also occur in dogs that are treated with progestogens for a long period of time to prevent cycling, and an increase in mammary development and risk to mammary tumors. Mammary tumors are also of interest in dogs because it's the number one cause of cancer that we see in our dogs worldwide. A large proportion of dogs worldwide are intact, so not spayed and neutered, and that tends to be the most common tumor type that you see in these dogs. So let's move on a little bit to talk about what the secret to success in dealing with reproduction. The key there is timing. So the best ideal situation is to put excellent quality semen into a fertile bitch at that right time. It's not always as easy as it sounds because of that variability that we see. So what tools do we have available to us? A lot of these are tools that we know very well and are well established in terms of finding that right fertile time period. And the more we get sophisticated with the reproductive techniques that we use, the more we have to utilize every aspect that we have available to us in terms of pinpointing that timing. So we look at things like behavior, how the dog is reacting, external signs. For all of us that have experienced bitches in heat, seeing that vulvar swelling, that bloody vaginal discharge. Also noticing things like using tools like vaginal cytology. So I have a diagram down here of how to obtain a vaginal cytology sample. Using things like vaginoscopy to look at the changes on the vagina, the vaginal epithelium in the bitch. And then hormone elevations. Here's that key of progesterone that we talked about, where the bitch is unique in that that progesterone begins to rise just prior to ovulation, and it can help us pinpoint other hormones like luteinizing hormone that comes from the pituitary to tell those ovaries to ovulate. So if we can combine all of these, then we can actually pinpoint that ideal fertile time frame. So this is just a diagram to show what we look at with vaginal cytology. Vaginal cytology can actually be considered an indirect assay of estrogen. So this is actually looking at estrogen's effect on the vaginal epithelium. As you are down in anestrus in that phase of the bitch, it's a very thin vaginal epithelium. Not a lot of cells come off on your cytology, and they're much smaller cells, nice healthy nuclei. As you move into proestrus, where we now have increasing levels of estrogen, we're going to start to see that vaginal epithelium thicken, and those cells are actually going to start to flatten out. So they look larger to us on our cytology samples. They still are nice and round when they're in this parabasal cell stage, so they're not the vaginal epithelium is just in that increasing time frame. As it starts to get thicker and thicker and these cells are further away from their blood supply, they become flatter and flatter, more unhealthy, and start to actually die off and lose those nuclei. So in an estrus cytology, when we're seeing our peak of estrogen, we'll actually see these cells become 100% of them superficial on our cytology, and starting many of them, greater than 50%, often lose their nuclei. While that's great, not every bitch reads the book, so that can sometimes be a challenge. If we're looking at vaginoscopy as another way to evaluate estrogen's effect on the vaginal epithelium, during proestrus in the bitch, estrogen is actually starting to peak in late proestrus, early estrus. And so in this time frame, you're going to see estrogen's effect of that thickened vaginal epithelium with lots and lots of moisture to that area, based on the effects that estrogen has on the vascular supply to that system. In later estrus, estrogen's actually on the decline. So while this epithelium is still thick, it starts to dry out, become whiter in appearance, and more crenulated. So this is just another tool we can look to see what estrogen is doing. The hard part is that estrogen doesn't tell us exactly when ovulation is going to occur. Estrogen is actually unique in the dog in that it's starting to decline by the time that LH peak occurs and subsequent ovulation. So this is, again, unlike some of the other species that we look at reproductively. So we can evaluate several hormones. One of them is luteinizing hormone, and we have tests available to measure luteinizing hormone, which is actually one of the most specific ways to tell ahead of time when that bitch is going to ovulate. The difficult part with this is that it's a very quick peak in the dog, as short as 12 hours in some instances, so it can be very hard to pick up. Like we mentioned before, we can look at estrogen levels and get an indirect evaluation of that by looking at those cells, the vaginal epithelial cells, the behavior of the bitch and her receptiveness. We can also look at progesterone, and it's a great way if we utilize both progesterone and luteinizing hormone. We can see that initial peak in initial rise in progesterone and go back and test to see when our LH peak potentially could have occurred. Another hormone to mention in the dog is relaxin, because hopefully our end goal is to get these bitches pregnant. Relaxin is a hormone that's produced by the placenta, and it is an available pregnancy test for dogs. Progesterone, this just is a chart to show us how progesterone can help us in terms of identifying that day of ovulation. It's amazing how consistent dogs actually can be in terms of this evaluation, and that generally around the time of a progesterone of 2 nanograms per mil, that usually coincides with the day of that LH peak. So we can use progesterone to help pinpoint that LH peak and go and then get an idea of 2 days generally after that is when ovulation is going to occur. Usually the progesterone has more than doubled. And 2 days after that, we're going to be breeding. So the ideal time frame for pinpointing that fertile period is generally breeding about 4 to 6 days after that LH peak. So let's move on a little bit and talk about some of the ways that we can try and control the estrus cycle of the bitch. This is one of the key factors when we talk about some of the newer technologies we're trying to implement in our assisted reproduction techniques. There are a couple ways we can try and manipulate the estrus cycle. One is to induce estrus. There are several hormones that we can use to attempt to induce estrus in the bitch. The difficult part with this is there's no one single protocol, there's not one single hormone that reliably and consistently induces estrus in the bitch. So that's the difficult thing that we are still dealing with today. We can do it by using gonadotropin. So this is actually an ovuplant that's designed for horses that has a gonadotropin agonist in it that is a longer-acting released implant. Often this is actually implanted into the vaginal mucosa or vulvar mucosa of the bitch, because if we're trying to breed her by inducing estrus, we need to remove that implant. We can also use that implant down here, leave it in, and that will initially induce estrus, but then prevent estrus thereafter. Down-regulates that hormonal axis. We can use some other hormones, such as dopamine agonists. A common one is cabergoline in dogs, that work by both direct effect on the hypothalamus, as well as by affecting prolactin. And the exact rationale for how that interaction with prolactin results in induction of estrus in bitch is still not known. So there's still a lot of questions we have about the reproductive physiology of the bitch. Estrogens have traditionally been used to induce estrus, but there are a significant number of side effects associated with that. In particular, we're very concerned about bone marrow suppression, which can be irreversible if that occurs. And so because of the safety concerns, we generally don't recommend using estrogens to induce estrus. We have other safer alternatives. Prostaglandins actually work by eliminating the corpus luteum, the source of progesterone. So while we consider that to try and control the estrus cycle, its effect is to shorten diestrus. We still need to go through that obligatory anestrus phase, so it's very inconsistent in trying to control the estrus cycle in the bitch. Another avenue is to try and prevent estrus from occurring, and then when you remove the drug, to try and have that bitch return to estrus in a relatively consistent time frame. Consistency is the key here. That's what's still lacking for what we use in terms of trying to manipulate these dogs' cycle. But one of the things that are several of the drugs that are commonly used are historically progestogens have been used for this. A lot of countries use progestogens that don't that have spay and neuter regulations where they're unable to do that unless there's a medical reason. So they need to find ways to manipulate the cycle. Progestogens traditionally have been used for that. Nowadays, those implants, the gonadotropins, are becoming much more popular for that purpose. Androgens are another way to go about that. So this is our picture of our dog on our bitch on steroids. So the tough part is like I said, we don't have a consistent mean to manipulate the estrus cycle still to date. So let's move on to talking about some of the ways that we can deal with sperm. We all know that there are natural service, which has the best conception rates. The more we manipulate semen, the more we potentially affect those conception rates. The better we are at understanding the physiology of sperm, the better we are in terms of improving that. So nowadays, we have fairly good success in using fresh collected semen and semen that is chilled and then shipped and used within 48 hours. Where we run into some issues is frozen semen. While it offers some great advantages to maintain the genetics of those dogs, we do suffer with some of our conception rates, as well as the fact that we have to utilize assisted breeding techniques in order to have success in using frozen semen. It's been around for quite a while. Frozen semen was actually first came about in the 1960s, but we are improving our understanding and our success rates with using frozen semen. How we can actually breed these dogs is certainly, many of us are certainly aware of artificial insemination with the traditional vaginal insemination, which is where semen is normally deposited in a natural mating. We like to see about 250 million normal motile sperm cells in order to have the best success rates with fresh semen. The more we manipulate it, or the potential that we don't have those numbers, we may need to get that semen into the uterus directly in order to have still maintain our conception rates. So we can do that by depositing it in several ways, either through the cervix or surgically. Frozen semen is best in terms of using it directly into the uterus, and in a lot of cases, because we're trying to freeze these cells in smaller breeding units to optimize the number of collections we'll get from our dogs. Traditionally, we are freezing dogs at about 100 to 200 million sperm per breeding unit. They can be frozen in either straws or pellets, and there's still a lot of debate about which potentially is the better technique and that remains to be answered. Depends on who you talk to. Someone who freezes in pellets feels that the pellets are better. Someone in straws feels the straws are better. New information is coming about, or new theories that have yet to actually be proven but are being studied currently, is that we may actually have better success by trying to freeze these dogs in smaller numbers but utilizing more frequent breedings during that cycle. So we may want to freeze these dogs more in the 50 million and breed them two or three times rather than 100 to 200 million to get one breeding. When we're using frozen semen, we need to deposit it directly into the uterus, and there's a variety of ways we can do that. One is to actually just go in surgically and deposit it directly, inject it directly into the uterine horns. We can also do that laparoscopically. It raises some welfare issues. In some countries, it's actually illegal to do this, and certainly has brought some significant debate about the potential risks for bitches by undergoing anesthesia and surgery for a breeding. So we've developed some techniques in order to bypass surgery and actually use a rigid cystoscope. So this is the scope here, and you can have a nice camera equipment. You don't necessarily need to have your video monitor there. But this picture actually shows this is the cervix with the catheter going right through. In other countries, there have been techniques developed, such as this is a Norwegian catheter technique, which is a specialized catheter. And for those that are extremely talented to palpate the cervix through the abdominal wall of the dog, they can stabilize the cervix and actually pass the specialized catheter through it. I'm not quite as talented as that, so I stick with the cystoscope for me. Some of the ways that we can work on some of the newer cutting-edge things that have been developed in terms of dealing with sperm is epididymal sperm harvest. So this offers a lot of advantages for potentially a recently deceased dog, a dog that you may not have been able to manually collect, a dog that may have been just recently castrated. We can certainly collect the sperm from the epididymis. We're able to actually cryopreserve the sperm currently. We can even ship this chilled to a freezing center if you're in a facility that doesn't have freezing available, in order to maintain some of those sperm cells in future use for those genetics of that dog. We've also gotten a little bit better with some of the types of semen extenders that are available. Working on semen extenders that can chill semen at refrigerator temperatures for as long as 8 to 10 days in some instances. Offer some advantages or at least the theory in dealing with that has been the concerns of trying to bypass, get through customs with liquid nitrogen type containers that can be difficult shipping internationally. We've looked at vitrification. So vitrification is actually forming a glass-like substance. And in traditional cryopreservation, it's a slow cooling process that balances the cooling of the sperm with dehydrating the sperm so ice crystals don't form in those sperm cells that are very detrimental to the cells. Vitrification is an ultra-rapid cooling process, so it's fairly similar in terms of that the fact that it's still using liquid nitrogen. It's just a much different rate and a much different concentration of cryoprotectants to dehydrate the sperm. It's been shown in other species, including humans. The difficulty is because of the water content of the sperm cells, it's not as effective as actually traditional cryopreservation, but it has become a very important way to deal with embryos. So this is actually an embryo that's been vitrified. We also look at sex sorting of semen, which is available in a variety of different species and offers the potential for dogs as well. A little bit different push, because certainly if you're dealing with species that only have one offspring and it makes a big difference if it's male or female, then that might be a different situation than our litter-bearing species, but just something to be aware of that potentially could be offered soon for dogs. It works by flow cytometry. So it's actually the sperm cells make its way all the way through this very small chamber, so each droplet contains one sperm cell. They're charged with a laser, and attracted to a plate based on whether it's an X sperm or a Y-bearing sperm. The difficulty with this technique is that if the sperm cells are just off at an angle, don't quite hit the charge properly, a large percentage of these cells end up not being able to be identified and are wasted. And so in that scenario, it significantly decreases the number of sperm cells you get from that particular collection. So when we deal with these low sperm numbers, we may need to talk about whether we need increased number of inseminations in that scenario. This has not yet been tested in dogs. What about the female side of it? Because we have a lot of things that are available for the males. The difficult part is a lot of the dogs, particularly our working dogs, it would be nice to be able to optimize the genetics of those best working dogs without actually having to remove them from the field in order to have a litter. The difficult part is there are definite advantages in terms of oocyte harvesting, oocyte cryopreservation, and in vitro fertilization in other species. It's available in humans. It's a very big growing industry in the cattle industry. Unfortunately, we don't have the success in dogs as we have in other species because of those unique aspects of the canine reproductive cycle we talked about earlier. We don't have the maturation media available to actually allow that oocyte to continue its division process, complete meiosis, like we do in other species where they ovulate an oocyte that has already completed meiosis. So that's the difficulty that we have in dogs. Another challenge is to find media where the sperm can become capacitated, so they'll undergo a chemical reaction where they're available to fertilize the oocyte. We're getting better at that part of it, but we're having a hard time with the oocyte aspect of it in canine reproduction. One of the shoot-offs that we may see of that is the availability to actually inject the sperm directly into the oocyte. So this is something that's been much more commonly used in humans and other species. They actually do this fairly readily in some of the cattle as well as mice. We can do this very frequently, but unfortunately, something that hasn't been reported yet in dogs. Okay. Another technique is to actually take the oocyte and the sperm and put it directly into the oviduct. Again, something that has not yet been reported in dogs, but as our knowledge of canine physiology grows, this may be something that's available in the near future. Embryo transfer could offer large advantages, just like we talked about with our working dogs. Unfortunately, because of all of those aspects with that are unique with the canine reproductive cycle, this is something that has been done in a research facility but is not yet commercially available. And in the future, what that might offer is that instead of just freezing sperm, we could cryopreserve or vitrify embryos. Cloning has been reported in dogs. This is actually Snuppy, who is the Seoul National University puppy. It was actually created in 2005. And basically with cloning, to simplify it as much as I possibly can, it's to basically take an oocyte, remove the DNA from that oocyte, and inject DNA from a cell, like a skin cell potentially, of the donor dog. So it was a skin cell that came from the donor dog, injected into the oocyte to create this. Sounds simple, doesn't it? It took 1,095 oocytes, 123 surrogates, to get two pregnancies that resulted in one live puppy. Believe it or not, despite that inefficiency, this is commercially available for anybody that has close to $500,000. So I won't spend too much time on genetic testing. I just wanted to mention this because I think it fits fairly well, and it was certainly very well done this morning. So this is pretty much a repeat of those types of tests. But I just wanted to mention that when we think about some of the genetic tests that are available, it's important to remember also the impact that's going to have on our selection criteria. We have a large number of genetic diseases that are known in dogs. We talked about all of the availability of that this morning and the different types of tests that are available, like mutation-based tests, link marker tests, as well. So sort of repeat, so I won't spend much time on it. Believe it or not, there are ways that we can now paternity test. So there, you can do multiple sire litters. And there is a test available called the mixed breed test. I'm sure most of you have heard of it. What's my mutt? So it's looking at breed-specific markers. And now that we have these particular things, certainly what's next? And we learned about a lot of those things that are available in the future, even as just this morning. So I just want to summarize in that the dog is very unique in its physiology. There's still a lot for us to understand about reproduction in dogs. But that's certainly going to be very important for us in terms of applying some of these reproductive techniques from other species in the future. And we are growing at an exponential rate in this knowledge. So the things that we talked about may seem like they are far-fetched today, but they are, everything that I talked about is available in other species, and it's soon to be applied to the dog. There's advantages and disadvantages, as well as limitations with all of these techniques. And I was thrilled to see that we're looking at reproduction, reproductive capability in our selection criteria, because the more we talk about interfering with natural reproduction in dogs, it's important for us to make sure that these dogs can still carry those reproductive sound traits. Because our goal is is to select those dogs that are both going to excel in service as well as in the whelping box. So hopefully we won't forget about that important part. So thank you very much for your attention. If anyone has any questions, thank you very much. Yes?
I've got a question. I had a female lab bitch that it was a mismatch. And years ago, the country vet gave her a shot, and I think he said it made the eggs pass out or whatever. And it was a horse product, I think. And it was the same thing happened again to me. And that product wasn't available any longer. Is there anything, kind of like a morning after pill for a dog or anything that can be done in the absence of that? And I also understand that that increased the chance of a urinary tract infection as well. So in retrospect, it was kind of a dangerous medicine to give a dog. But is there anything on the market today that can help us if that accident occurs again that we can give the dog as a safe product?
Sure. So the question is that what type of mismate type shots that we have available that used to be available to dog breeders if there was an accidental breeding that occurred. Probably that injection was an estrogen because that was the most common product that was used. If it was just like a morning after type pill, it was immediately after that mismate that would occur. Currently, because of the concerns that we've found with using estrogens, particularly at that high rate, and the largest being this irreversible bone marrow suppression, we don't recommend estrogens because of that those safety concerns associated with it. There is actually no labeled drug in dogs for this country that's for use for mismating. And in fact, I forgot to mention it, but for estrocycle control, there are no labeled drugs for dogs in this country for estrocycle control. So that's where we're actually very far behind our European counterparts in terms of the availability of those drugs. There's a fabulous drug in Europe that's actually an anti-progestogen drug that is very similar. It's chemically related to the morning after pill in this country. But because of the legal implications in this country, veterinarians are not able to have access to it. There are methods that we can use to deal with mismates that occur. In general, a large proportion of those, because of the fact that the timing may not be correct, are not fertile breedings. So we prefer before starting a dog on any medication to confirm they're actually pregnant. And then we can use a combination of cabergoline, your dopamine agonists, as well as prostaglandins. We can also use dexamethasone. There's a variety of ways that we can actually terminate pregnancies if they're unwanted. Any other questions? Thank you very much.